I'm delighted to introduce you to our newest supporting sponsor, a team human enabler in more ways than one, Groucho. Groucho's a platform that answers the most common question we get at Team Human: how do I find the others? Well, this is it. Go to mygroucho.club/teamhuman, share your interests and aspirations, and Groucho's curators will hand assemble a real dinner club for you. You meet twice a month in order to establish some lasting friendships. Groucho takes care of all the logistics. The thing I like is that it was built by artists, not tech pros, people who wanted to recreate what they got from artist residencies, curated intentionally, and with time and space to connect. That's how the founders met their own best collaborators, friends, and even life partners. So check out mygroucho.club/teamhuman for 50% off the first month. That's mygroucho.club/teamhuman. Find the others. You're on Team Human, Conscious Intervention in the Machine, an opportunity to embrace the weird, inhabit the liminal, find someone's hand, and then together look squarely and lovingly into the darkness. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and I'm on Team Human. Playing for Team Human today, someone who's been navigating noir consciousness for four decades as bassist for Bauhaus, Love and Rockets, and the pulse of humanity itself, David J. Haskins. It's time to intervene on behalf of the human heart, the chaos, the Gaia, and Eros that got us here in the first place. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and we're all on Team Human. David, thanks.
Hello, Douglas. I love that introduction there.
I thought you'd recognize some of the references I'm trying to make there. For those of you who don't know David and his work, trust me, you should. Listen to a couple of Bauhaus records and then some Love and Rockets records and then some David J. records, and you'll know where I was at in, 2 years ago now, 3 years ago, when I met David. We had just released, they just did a documentary about the life of Genesis Peorage. Mm. And I was in the band Psychic TV, which is one of the bands he started. So we did a tribute concert to Genesis for a Tribeca Film Festival when the movie opened. And some superstars from my era of listening to music came, you know, it was, you know, Bob Burt from Sonic Youth, and Cynthia Slay from the Bush Tetras. And then we found out that David J. was going to come. And it's funny, I can do this, I'm allowed. As musicians, we were all like so excited that you were going to come in the room, because we're all just fanboys of what you do. And also to know that Genesis, who was our friend who died, meant enough to you for you to come and be there and channel him and all. And then you came, and I remember it was like the second rehearsal. And we're all, you know, just being normal, because we want to be normal. But we're also just like, isn't he cool? Oh, my God, he was so fun. We came in and you were doing, we were doing Suspicious.
Yes.
It was a song you did. And the first time you came in, and we were just kind of getting it right. Then you came in for a second rehearsal of it. And you kind of embodied a few different people as you did it. Like you were starting, I remember the first verse, it was sort of like you were sort of this young person doing it. Then like the second verse, you were trying out like a Lou Reedy kind of thing. And then the third verse, it felt like you were doing like this, a little, I don't know, it was like a Southern gospel sort of something was coming through. And I was like, oh, that's weird. And then as you were doing the Southern sort of thing, it's just like, I don't know what, like that Memphis sound, something was coming through your voice. I did a little, I was like, oh, these chords could work rather than the regular chords I'm playing. They could work as gospel chords, kind of like this is this. And I did that, and you just looked over and smiled, and you went and gave me a thumbs up.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just like, it's the sweetness of, you know, I mean, this is a dark song, Suspicious. You know, it's like dark stuff we're doing and playing. But the sweetness of turning, and it was like, oh my God, David J just gave me the thumbs up. Because he heard me here in the moment. You heard me hear you.
Yes.
And that I went along with it. And then...
yeah, you responded. Yeah. I mean, I was just feeling my way on that. I'd never performed that before. And it wasn't conscious me, you know, deciding... oh, I'll try a Lou Reed on this,
yeah,
or anything like that. I'm just being very intuitive, and it's just instinctual and very, very much in the spirit of Genesis, who was so that, the embodiment of that, really a kind of shamanic conduit for that kind of flow, like nobody I've ever really encountered,
right?
You know. Very spontaneous, but I can be like that as well. And that was something that we related to, you know. And we were in the studio together a couple of times. But yeah, and then we did, the other piece that we did was, it was a dream that I, it was a transcript of a dream that I had had about Genesis. And Genesis has visited me in dreams for decades. And I once told him this, and he said, oh, but that makes sense, because I do most of my magical work in the dream world. In fact, my magical name is Dreamwalker. Mm. And it was a bit of I was somewhat taken aback that a magician would reveal his magical name, but he did, and I felt quite honored about it in that regard. But anyway, I had this dream, and then I told a friend, a mutual friend of mine and Jen's, about the dream. And this is Isan Spevak. He used to play violin for me. And she now goes by Me, which was a name that Jen gave her, as Jen would, you know, name his acolytes. And she sort of gasped and said, well, when you had that dream, we were burying Jen in a secret location in the forest. And so John Giorno, another mutual friend, once said to me that if you the person who has just passed comes to your consciousness, then you are with them in the bardo, you know, in the Buddhist bardo. Because I had an experience where, relating to William Burroughs, another mutual friend. And I'd moved to America. This was in 97. And all my stuff was in this garage. It was like being used as a storage unit. And it was all in cardboard boxes. And very few things had been taken out. But one day I just woke up with this. It was a compulsion to find one object. I just had to find it. And there was no real... logical reason why I would need to find this thing, but I had to. And that was a mask that William Burroughs gave me when I visited him in Lawrence, Kansas. It was a Japanese theatrical mask that he painted himself, and he signed it. But I felt compelled. I had to find this mask. And I was just digging through all these boxes. And I finally retrieved it. And I took it straight into the house. And I was just about to put a nail on the wall to hang it. And my father-in-law came in. And he said, oh, what's that? And I told him. And he said, oh, did you know that he died today? And I didn't. I wasn't aware of that fact. But I told this to John Giorno. And he said, oh, you were with William in the bardo, and then because of that, you know.
The other thing you did on the Psychic TV tribute was you brought a dream box.
Yeah, Frank's box.
Right, which is this radio. It's basically a radio. It's funny because I'm teaching a course now in media and magic, which is looking at how all the different phonograph, telephone, all the different media were used to try to connect with the dead at one point or another.
Mm-hmm.
And this is basically, it's a radio sweep. And it'll catch words from songs or broadcasts that are happening, but the idea is the words that are getting caught are a bit like a kind of a radio Ouija board for other entities to communicate, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes,
and
that's the theory. Yes,
and then you said the poem of the dream over that.
I had that running live. on the stage.
Right.
Yeah.
I know, and you entrusted me to have to do it every to bring it up every 15 seconds or something. Yes. To hear what was going to come.
Yeah, we had a system.
Yeah.
Worked out. I mean, the sound was very noisy and chaotic, so it was hard to discern, you know, but it was all part of the sort of texture.
Mm.
And it was in there, and whether there was anything discernible, you know, that had been relayed from the afterlife, I'm not sure.
Well, it's less important than the invitation his presence.
Yes,
you know?
Yes. A portal was opened.
He was listening. Anyway, he was listening, more importantly, because you were the one talking at that point.
Yeah.
We were playing for him. So.
Yeah. That dream as well is interesting because in the dream, I was at a gathering, and it was a tribute event for Genesis, and it turned out that it was a memorial for Genesis, and Genesis was there, and there was a lot of people there, and he saw me and came over, and we were talking. And he looked, and this is an interesting thing. I've experienced dreams where I've encountered the dead. And relatives and friends. And they usually appear to be a certain age, which is early 30s. And they usually look great. And Jen appeared to me in the dream in that way. And we had a Brian Jones page boy haircut.
Mm.
And was dressed in gold, a silver lame. And he looked great. But anyway, his attention was diverted and he had to go elsewhere. But he said, I've got something for you. Don't leave. You know? And Jen would always be very generous with me and give me many gifts, which I still have, of course, a lot of books. And he finally appeared and he had a book for me, a commemorative book. But he couldn't get to me because of the crowd, you know, wanting to get his attention. So he gave this sweet little smile and waved. But then it dawned on me that when we were at that event, that was the event that I dreamed of.
You know? Mm.
It was kind of prophetic because it was that gathering and it had the same feeling to it. So interesting, you know.
Right, which means he was both there and with you. It's interesting we talk about him as a he, you know, because I know them and she and all.
Yes.
But it's partly because my formative experiences with Jen were grounded when Jen was he. And my post-passing experiences with Jen, Jen is gendered, has been gendered male in the
Exactly the same. I mean, I met Jen in 1979. When Bauhaus opened for Throbbing Gristle in Northampton, my hometown, we played at the town hall.
Mm.
And that's where we first met and stayed in touch. But I must say, I always kept Jen at arm's length to a degree.
Really?
Yeah. I was always quite wary. And he made several overtures to me, like entreaties for us to collaborate, which I didn't accept. It was just an intuitive feeling.
It was difficult. Interestingly, it was difficult. I tried to collaborate a couple of times and got him really, really mad once, frighteningly so. And I was like, oh, wow, this is, you know, to have a tripwire that was that. I was like, okay, you know, and I enjoyed playing in the band, but after a certain amount of time, and it wasn't that it's like that I have ego. But it was almost like, okay, there's a certain point at which I am in, no matter how much of a loving thing PTV is, we are in Jen's band. This is, and it's like, okay, I'm doing his trip, and now I want to do my trip or a different trip or something. So it was the same with Timothy Leary too, that these people, a lot of the greats, they have such strong sort of zones of personality around them that you're either sort of submit to the cult that they've created or you maintain a little distance.
I got to know Tim a little bit towards the end of his life. And we were actually talking about collaborating. It was Love and Rockets. He was interested in Love and Rockets, yeah, making some music for some of his psychedelic videos. And Howard Hallis, who I believe you know, was working on
that. Got his picture
that.
Over my, a picture he made over my bed right now.
Yes, yeah. He's an incredible individual and an artist.
Mm-hmm.
Real freak in the best possible way.
Yeah.
And it was he who introduced me to Tim. And I went to a party. That was the first time I met him. And then he came to a gig that Genesis was playing, a cinematic in LA.
Mm.
And I met him again there. And then the last time I saw him, he'd extended a kind invitation to pop in anytime. He was up in the hills. And,
yeah, yeah.
And so I went over with a friend of mine, Billy Goodrum. And it was like midday, and I bought him a bottle of wine, but he immediately grabbed it and opened it and said, "Let's go on the patio and drink this," you know. And he was just very expansive, open, and relaxed. And that was a lovely meeting. And then he was interested in, as I said, Love and Rockets, and he wanted to see us live. And so we were on tour in the States, and I called him up. Phoned him up to invite him to this gig, I was a bit taken aback because he sounded feeble, like his voice was notably different, and he said, you know, he's not going anywhere, you know, he's just bedridden, but he said, "I'll be there in spirit," and that's the last thing he said to me. And then we played that show, and then it wasn't that show, but I believe the show after that, and he died.
Yeah. It went fast at the end.
And but there was an extraordinary thing that happened at that gig. And I was thinking of Tim during that gig, very consciously. And we played most of the set. We went into this song, Yin and Yang, the Flower Pot Man. It has a kind of Bo Diddley rhythm that Daniel Ash, the guitarist, starts. And instead of striking it, as he usually did, he hit it in a weird way, and it made this strange kind of ricochet sound, and it echoed. We were in a big hall. It was about, you know, like 3,000 capacity, and this sound just sort of echoed around the room. And I thought, "Oh, please, Daniel, just let this go," and he did, and he just went like that. And he just let it go. And then it went, it changed, and it started to sort of become this rhythmic, like boom, 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 boom. It was just from the guitar. And the crowd picked up on it and started to clap. And then my brother, Kevin, on the drums, boom, 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 on the bass drum. And I just started banging my bass, boom, boom, boom. And then this cacophony built and built and built, and it became something transcendental. And then Daniel goes into the rhythm and we played the song. And now the end chorus of that song is beauty, 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 beautiful. A repeat of that. And I told Howard what happened. And he said, "I was with Tim." And he said, do you know what his last words were? I said, "No." He said, "Beautiful."
Yeah.
So, and I thought, "I'll be there in spirit."
There you go. So this is the perfect entree to what I'm trying to engage with you about and engage with the world about is this could be in some ways considered the goth sensibility. Do you know what I mean? The to some it's like
necromancy.
Right. The death and whatever. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's the darkness. Oh, it's a, and it's like, but no, it's the beauty and the life and the innocence and the opening and the connection that you get from being able to sit with the darkness. When you sit with a person who's dying, as I have, and at first you initially experience it as obligation, and then you realize it's opportunity, it's blessing, you know. And then when I saw this. David Jay's new book. It's a book of we can call them poems, for lack of a better word, You can call them prayers. You can call them lamentations. You can call them meditations. You can call them songs. Rhapsody, serenity, and prayer, which is a really interesting triptych that I tripped out on since I've had the book, that, you know, there are these poems of rhapsody which are, for me, they're sexy, incarnate, tasty, fresh, groundy, you know,
good.
Dirty in a good way.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, then there's threnody, which I had to look up the word. I remembered it, but I didn't.
Yeah.
That threnody is like lamentation, like ode, like a, you know, Keats, like ode to someone who died.
They're, yes.
They're that, but think of the word threnody as that kind of lamentation. It's like, it's a flip. And then finally, prayers. That to me, these are the three elements of all the stories that you're telling, that there's an immersion in the flesh, you know, a readiness and acceptance of where we are through the music, through the rhythm, through the – when the beat starts, it's like, wait. You know, the rhapsody is the willingness to say, I'm not going to play the song. We're going to let this thing come through our body, right? Mm-hmm. And that got you to the threnody, the lamentation, to find the beautiful, to the prayer of us right now going, oh my gosh, I'm so grateful to be alive in this universe where Genesis can be with us, you know, or Timothy could do that. And that's what these – to me, that's the working here is that. I don't even know where to start. I mean, so in some ways, rhapsody, threnody, and prayer, I was understanding it as kind of love, loss, and innocence. You know, that there's so many of the stories, the poems, the songs that you've done, the stories you tell. It feels like this three-part process, rhapsody, threnody, and prayer, or love, loss, and innocence, is related to your creative process, to the way that you there's a sort of a love involved in the work you do, like the experience I had with you, just connecting with the other musician. There's that sense of channeling, of openness with the radio, and that it's not just you and you're going to see what comes through. But in the end, it brings you not where people think that this kind of work would bring you, to like some dark garbage pail kid, you know, the way that most people look at Genesis, say, as this little demon person. Mm. But it brings you to this sweetness, this—
And light.
This light.
Yeah, you could say even a Luciferian light, a kind of—
Right. Which, of course, was Scare Mother, but—
Yeah, but in the truest sense of that.
Right.
Transcendental light.
Right. Right. So I just wrote, if you look here, this transcendental object. This is what I said to myself, we should talk. I just, so funny that was the very next thing I had on there was the transcendental. That it's a collection, but it's dimensionalized. Hmm. Right. That way you get a transcendental object is with the triptych format, or the three process, the bardos, that what we're trying to do is as artists or as writers is somehow dimensionalize experience.
Or impose a system in order to better understand it, you know.
Right.
Or to go deeper.
You build a process. You do this.
Yeah. Yeah. See, that the idea of that triptych came after the poems. And those poems, they span quite a vast period. So the earliest one, I think, is 1977. And the most recent one is last year. And it's pretty much, I don't write a lot of poetry. Mm. It's pretty much all there in that book. There's a few things that aren't, but that didn't make the grade. But I had this cache of material, and I just thought, how can I impose a structure on it? Is there something here that's identifiable as a theme or themes? And then I saw it really clearly. You know, it does. There is a division there of the rhapsodic, and then the threnody section, the eulogies, etc. And then the prayer. The prayer is sincere. It's not really innocent, Sir Douglas. It's really more, you know, the conventional meaning of that word. It's a heartfelt, sacred dedication and it's wishing someone well. And it's, you know, it's a very in earnest, has an in earnest intention in that regard.
Right. But that the earnest, I guess I always associate the earnestness with a childlike innocence, you know, the petition to.
Yes.
Who's the other in the prayer? Is it God? Well, I guess it's whoever you're the
well, it's very specific. It's actually a family member
right.
who had a lot of.
What tech taketh away, it can also giveth back. Think about it. We've handed our social lives over to platforms designed to keep us clicking, not connecting, turned human relationships into follower counts and reaction metrics. Our new favorite sponsor, Groucho, is a corrective. Founded by artists who want to flip the script, instead of atomizing us like a social network, they connect people in real life. Human curators place you in a local club with people who complement your interests and your journey. Share evenings out with your club twice a month until real connections take hold. Then, the people at Groucho place you into a new hand-assembled club for the social fabric to grow. Groucho wasn't built by tech bros, but artists who wanted to recreate the serendipity of their own art residencies, where they found lifelong collaborators, friends, even life partners. So come on, Team Human, let's find the others. Go to mygroucho.club/teamhuman for 50% off the first month. That's mygroucho.club/teamhuman.
Mental illness issues. Brilliant person, but a very harrowing journey dealing with all of that. And it was written in the midst of caring for that person.
Mm. Yeah, and there's also a lot of travel in these poems. There's what's that place in England? Macclesfield.
Macclesfield
yes. Sunday.
On a Macclesfield Sunday, which is about Ian Curtis, and Macclesfield is where Ian lived. Mm. And now, see, I was privy and privileged to be given all of Ian's letters to Anik, his lover in Belgium, by a film director who was he was actually this preceded the film Control. I'm sure you've seen that. Very well done by Anton Corbijn, and of course he's the ideal person to direct a movie. But the what preceded that was this screenplay that was based on the same thing on Deborah Curtis's book Touching from a Distance, and it had got to the stage of there was interest in financing, and the director he wanted me to do the soundtrack to it, and so as inspiration he loaned me all of these letters, and I felt a bit uncomfortable about it because they're so private, you know. And I focused and I asked Ian, is this okay? Is this okay, mate, you know? And I perceived that I received a thumbs up, yes. Open the cache, you know. So I read them in one sitting and it was incredibly moving. And he just pours his heart out to this woman. And it is obvious to me that he couldn't do that with his wife because there wasn't the bandwidth, you know. Ian was very, very curious and knowledgeable and enthusiastic about art and music and film and in Anik. He had somebody who was in the same place and they could share, you know, this enthusiasm and love for all these things. And she was a promoter. She actually put on a Bauhaus gig very early in Belgium at a place called Planquet, which is an incredible venue. And Geordie Vision played there just before us on the same bill as William Burroughs. And we kind of knew Anik. She's a lovely woman and very, very tuned in to like the new music coming up and just art in general. And so I could totally see Ian, you know, finding this resonance with her. But there's one long letter where he's talking about this melancholia of being in Macclesfield, especially on a Sunday when all the shops are closed and the churches are open. And he likes to go down to the canal. And I could just see him. I just saw him there just in his long trench coat, you know, wandering down with his cigarettes, you know, on Valium. And just in this kind of poetic, melancholic reverie, which is a certainly state that he did embody. And I drew on that writing that poem. So a lot of those references come directly from that letter to Anik. And he's talking about going to see Apocalypse Now and what an impression it made on him. And things like that. And walking by the factory where they used to make parachutes. And then I thought, oh God, that's so powerful. Like that's, I just envisaged the ghosts still working at the looms, making the parachutes. And then I put in a line about each Tommy would pack his own, you know, he would jump without one, diving into the unknown. You know, there was so much there to draw from. So that's where that came from.
Mm.
I should tell you this because I was really taken aback by one of the letters, which is actually a postcard to Anik, and he talks about wanting to see Bauhaus. And I was not anticipating this. Michael didn't say or anything, and he just gave them to me. And he's talking about, oh, I really like this band Bauhaus. I've got both their records. So this was like 1980. And he said, they're playing in London, and I'm hoping our recording sessions for the next album coincide so I can go and see them. And that happened, and he did come down. That's where I met him. At that gig.
Mm.
So that was a shivery moment, you know.
It's funny. I mean, as you talk, there's like neighborhoods of people, you know. So there's, you know, William Burroughs and Geisen and Robert Anton Wilson and Joe Coleman and Tim Leary you know, and you and Ian. And it's... You know, I just did that interview with Brian Eno, and he said he doesn't use the word genius. He uses the word senius.
Okay.
That there's like a scene of people from whom things emerge. And some are in front and maybe like sort of front people for it. Some are not. But it's like for me, it's more like I find out that some person's, you know, some hero of mine, you know, has died and oh, you know, there's a copy of Team Human on his bedside or something. And it's great. Like, oh, I'm in there. It makes me feel like part of the mix, you know. It's even if it's not, you know what I mean. I'm not on the stage necessarily doing it, but I'm in the scenius being expressed. We're metabolizing something, you know, something together.
A connectedness, and it's like you know, find the others. Tim Leary,
right? Which is on the back of the Team Human book. That's the
is it?
It's the thing on it.
Okay,
yeah,
okay. Find
that's
the others.
The theme of this show is literally the find the others. But there's these moments when it, like when you were, was it last night or? Did you do Beauty of Broken Things?
Yes, which is from the, it's a forthcoming album, and it's a concept album about the life of Egon Schiele, the Austrian painter.
But the line, the repetition, the beauty of broken things, you know, on the one, as a child, it's like the island of misfit toys or something, but the beauty of broken things is part of the healing that this work is about. It's to see the beauty. I mean, that is the goth girl from Southern California, is the person who feels broken, you know, and we don't pick on them. We don't ridicule them. We see the beauty in that broken person. It's like seeing the silence, the stillness, the sacredness of death. You know, it's not, we're not talking about the darkness of the satanic ritual. It's the darkness of the cathedral at midnight,
yes.
You know?
But I love the Leonard Cohen line, you know, there's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in.
Mm.
It's all in that line.
Right. And then holding what's the implication then is how do you live a life gentle enough. And that's when that's the essence I get from you is you're strong, but so gentle. It's like, how do you maintain yourself in a gentle enough way to hold the broken thing?
You learn by living and being loud and receiving a negative reaction to that loudness, a slap, if you like. And then you learn to basically, you know, shut the fuck up and listen.
Mm.
Hold your tongue, listen, and say something if you got something to say. And try not to be too readily judgmental, because you don't know what's going on in a person's life that would result in them coming out with something you might, you know, just as a knee-jerk reaction, react negatively to. But you like listen, see where they're coming. Why are they saying that? I think I suppose you could call that wisdom. You know.
Yeah, and it's a form of compassion. I mean, there's that. Yeah. There's the Sam Shepard story in Motel Chronicles that you responded to so deeply about this girl who lives in the town where they're shooting, and she resembles
the star stand-in, yeah.
Right.
And she lives in the limelight she lives in a fantasy for two weeks while they're shooting there, you know. And then she has a moment, you know, where they're lighting for the star, but she's the stand-in. So she stands in that light, but then it's this great sadness that the light is leaving town. You know, she looks so very like her in the right light, but that light is leaving town. Yeah, that idea, it just really got to me.
I know. And then you told the story about how Sam Shepard on the set, you know, that she gets all drunk and she's all over him, and she brings him back to her room.
Well,
brings him back to his.
He takes her to his room. This is the last night when they've wrapped everything, and it's in the motel. And yeah, she's in a bit of a state, and he does take her to the room, but you know, not for any seductive, nefarious reasons. He sits her down, and he's very compassionate, and he just lets her talk, and he talks to her, and he takes her hand gently and guides her through this problematic situation that she's found herself in, you know.
Yeah, but I guess what you saw in that, that you resonated with it, is sort of the way I resonate with your music. It's like, oh, that the kindness, the ability to hold the broken person, you know. And then you know, I was at your show last night, and the line that kept sticking with me was. Someone shot nostalgia in the back, you know. And you had done songs about, you know, the Rose Garden and Jackie O, and you know, there was some nostalgia in the work, you know. But when you said someone shot nostalgia in the back, I mean, it's interesting. My knee jerk reaction was, you know, how certainly in my work, I have to avoid anything that looks like nostalgia, because that once they can label it as nostalgia, the thing I'm saying is then it's as if it's off the table. It's been discredited. Oh, that's just boomer nostalgia.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And when you took a stand by saying someone shot nostalgia in the back, it's like, my God, they did shoot nostalgia in the back.
Well, that's from a song, Who Killed Mr. Moonlight. It's a Bauhaus song. And it's the only Bauhaus song that I sing. It was on our fourth album. And the inspiration for that was actually initially the death of John Lennon.
Mm.
And someone shot nostalgia in the back. Someone shot at innocence. That was a spark. But then, as these things often do, they mutate and they transform and they become something other than that point of the original inspiration. And so it became more abstract. And then later on, I looked at that song as also it could mean Mr. Moonlight is an aspect of Bauhaus, the band. It's the romantic, very romantic aspect, the melancholic, dreamy, poetic, beautiful side of the of the band, and that was shot in the back. Mm. And then there's another murder mystery there, you know. So I'll leave that at that point. Interpret that as you wish and try to solve that true crime if you so desire.
And the other true crime, though, is the one. It's interesting that I feel like, yeah, Bauhaus and Love and Rockets, particularly in the darker moments, the moments where it was willing to look death in the face, was in some sense prophetic of the moment we're in now. In other words, we are, I feel like now we are, I'm hoping, spoiler alert, we're watching a civilization die. You know, we're watching the yeah. end of something here. Mm. And people are now they're in the mourning. Now they're in the, you know, they've reached the serenity for what we've known as we move into the unknown. And sure, it could be the birth of something else, something new, but.
That's where the prayers come in.
Right. But I feel like that the Bauhaus and the goth and the noir kind of foretold, it was like preparation for where we are now. And in some ways, I mean, I don't know if you're experiencing it this way. I know when careers have ebbs and flows, but it feels like all of your work, it's back in, people are more aware of it again. People are hungrier for it again. Yeah. You know, they're this book, it keeps being sold out. There's, you know, Genesis had that moment too, like after a sort of a early aughts lull, it was like then all of a sudden everyone wanted.
It resonates. Yeah.
It resonates again. Yeah. So it's back in that way. Do you feel it's that? It's the people are ready to engage with the darkness of this moment?
I think they're being forced to. You know, they've been pushed to because it's there in your face. And we can't turn away from it anymore. And it's manifesting in many different ways. Politically more than anything, I think it's the most, you know, the most prevalent, you know, expression of that darkness.
Right.
I mean, fascism is like the pure, you know, distillation of that, of darkness, of evil, really.
Right. And it's what can't hold. The broken gets eliminated under fascism.
Yes, it's crushed.
The weak are crushed.
Yeah. Except, you know, you look at history and it never lasts. And the little bud pokes through the cracked concrete, you know. And that is hope and love and light. And that's much stronger than fascism. That's much stronger than a jackboot.
Right. I know. And people, you know, accuse Jen of being like fascist because of the, you know, the sacred cross symbol. On the show.
Yeah, well, there was a flirtation there, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, essentially, Jen was the opposite of a fascist.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, then it was the flirtation is more like, can I tolerate this bad trip? Can I, how do I, in an effort to metabolize it, you know, to say, okay, here's the darkest thing there is.
Can I look into the abyss?
Yeah, exactly. Bring it on. Bring it on.
Jen did look into the abyss. Yeah.
Right. And made it through as a pantragene.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
So that's where that'll.
Yeah.
That's where that'll take you. But I find it, because I look at some of the work, like when you've got the, you know, the song about paving the rose garden.
You know, yeah, the rape of the rose garden.
The rape of the rose garden, which now we know is even more than all that. That it's the ballroom that they're putting down is a bomb shelter, command center. You know, he's admitted
I wrote that in 2020 when, you know, indeed, you know, the desecration, the initial desecration of the rose garden was happening, and I was just appalled by that. And it was just not just on the level of it being, you know, destroying something was a beautiful thing, but the metaphor for the country, you know, and for all things bright and beautiful, you know. And and indeed, you know, a few years later we get the destruction of an entire wing of the White House, you know. and then the proposed, you know, construction of this monstrosity that could, as you suggest, be more than a ballroom. But yeah, these times are so intense. Just right. what we're witnessing here, especially in America. My word.
But you would argue still to this day that nostalgia isn't just nostalgia. In other words, nostalgia shouldn't be used as a put down.
No. I mean, nostalgia can be, it can, you can wallow in nostalgia and, you know, it can be a negative thing, but there's also, you know, a beautiful poetic reverie there in the nostalgic, as long as you just don't get caught up with it and you just live in the past, you know. Can we be nostalgic for the future?
But that's the other, you know, the other thing that can happen. I mean, the work that you do kind of has to happen in music, because you can collapse the future and the past. You can retrieve Bowie or Reed or anything and future, you know what I mean? And future cast it at the same time. It creates this.
Or, I mean, there was, you know, a notion of the future that was abroad in, say, in the 1950s and 60s.
Mm.
Flying cars, etc., and all that, you know, and kind of utopia. And I suppose, you know, that is a future that we have nostalgia for, you know.
Yeah, nostalgic, you know, for the space age.
The potential, the dream of the future.
Right. Which was the space age, not whatever they call it, the Kessler syndrome. Have you heard of that one where the satellites all hit each other and they break into such small pieces that no one can even, you can't get off the planet again because they're all ricocheting around.
Yeah.
It'd be an ironic way to trap ourselves on this sphere.
Very.
I guess what I'm interested in, you're not much older than me, but you carry a different toolbox of wisdom. What, if anything, is keeping you up at night now? I mean, I'm unresolved about, you know, this whole end of the world thing and the end of our civilization and the pain and Gaza, and it makes me anxious. Are you worried about things?
Sure. All of that, you know, all of that. And it's heightened when you have friends that are in those hot spots. As I do. That's the real human element to all this. Like it becomes, and of course the fascists trade on this, the kind of the vague other that's out there that you don't personally know. And then it's taken to the next level where that other is demonized. But to have personal friends who you love in Gaza and on the streets of Minneapolis, then it becomes very, very urgent and real. And there's a focus there, you know, and then those friends, they are representative of the ones that you don't know. But you feel it on that very close level. So, yeah, I mean, it's very concerning. I think all we can do really is just be kind and good to our neighbors and help, you know, on a local level wherever we happen to be, and extend that compassion and kindness and thoughtfulness.
Yeah, I mean, that's the place I got with this. To some critique, I mean, not that I will go march, you know, King's Day or one of those people, AOC or Naomi Klein tells me to march, I march. But for the most part, it feels like, you know, and I can preach, you know, love and such, you know, through my work. But it feels like it's in the moment engagement with the other is the best we can do. Be kind to your neighbors. Do favors for people.
Yeah.
Help.
Yes.
And that trickles up and out, and it makes our communities less dependent on these collapsing structures.
Yes. And when you are traveling, extend that to strangers. Wherever you happen to be.
Right. Right. And when you are traveling, I mean, which I still do some, make it worth it. You know, if you're going to be spending the fuel and the energy and all to do it, and it should be a genuine gift to someone or something. If you're going to take, you know, take that amount of resource.
Yeah.
I know it's unsatisfying for people, especially with the sort of 20th century political movement mindset, you know, that 8 billion people just acting compassionately for each other, you know, would that be enough? Actually, I think it would.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
I mean, which is where the art, the work, the poems, that all that works feels then like a form of activism.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, my as far as my art and activism is concerned, I do send out these little missives, messages, mainly through music, you know. I'm no stranger to the protest song, you know. And the most recent single was, in fact, an anti-ICE song called Ice Too Cold to Thaw. And it was, we made it a charity record, me in cahoots with my friend Shepard Fairey, who designed the cover and also did a limited edition print. And we sold that as a bundle, and we made quite a lot of money for the law school in LA, who specialize in helping immigrants who can't afford that kind of service, you know.
And it's interesting when you bring in a name, I mean, we'll go back and put all the names that we've talked about in the show notes, but then you bring in Shepard Fairey. It's like Shepard Fairey, for people who don't know, he did the Obey stickers and the Andre the Giant has a posse. I mean, he's an artist mimeticist, right? He's playing with memes and overlap and Obey and what we could have to call an occult science, you know?
Sure.
And it's part, it's that same neighborhood of people, you know?
Yeah.
That keep, that we all know each other to some extent, but work in this same, because cut and paste and a slight darkness, usually some drugs here or there, And ultimately the gentility, the sweetness when you hear about even William Burroughs' death. I mean, he said, it's love. Love it. Everything is love. It's all love.
Yes.
Or Leary.
The last thing he wrote was that. Yeah. The most effective painkiller. Yeah. The love.
You know, that's where this work goes is, it's reassuring, I mean, to me, on a certain level, to not be afraid to go through that dark place, or through the sadness, through the serenity.
Yeah. Well, that was always the thing with Bauhaus. It was always going towards the light.
Mm.
And on the journey, not shying away from also flirting with the appealing poetic romanticism of darkness, but seeing it for what it is. But there's also like heavy darkness, and to just go through that rather than push it away, and with the ultimate desire to come through it and to be completely consumed by the light.
Well, being the bass player for that seems like it's a good position to be in on that journey through that. Because
well, everybody plays their part, you know.
But you know what I mean? It's sort of the walk. It's the it's the stepping.
It's the anchor, though.
Yeah. I mean, do you feel that when you write lyrics and poems, do you feel like as a that you're playing bass through it, that the rhythm is coming as
no,
if it comes from another place?
Not bass. I mean, it has this rhythm. Rhythm is very important to lyrics and to the poems. No, it's not. It's not associated with the bass, though. In my mind, it's just pure rhythm.
Mm.
It's meter. It's flow. Yeah.
Yeah, because I see you, you know, in shows now playing guitar.
Like last night, yeah. Mm. Decided to take a leap into the dark.
Mm.
No, put the guitar down. Yeah, you got to do it. Got to take chances.
Yeah.
Got to take those leaps. I do. I do love taking a leap in the dark. And I like it when things go wrong.
Right.
Because that opens up another portal possibility, you know. And you mentioned Eno earlier. I mean, he's somebody who really embraces that.
Yeah. And the great actors, you know. I knew this great theater people, another guy named Morris Karnofsky was in the group theater way back when in America, you know, with Stella Adler and all those folks. He was our acting teacher at this acting school I was at. Mm. And the story he always told was, you know, he was in Waiting for Lefty, this Broadway show by Clifford Odets. And he was in the room. Someone was supposed to make their entrance. And they didn't come in.
Okay.
And he ended up, you know, being alone on stage for like 4 or 5 minutes while waiting. And he ended up looking at each object in the room and thinking for himself why each one represented the most contemptible thing about this other character that he hated. And it ended up being this moment written about, you know, by all the scores because of how brilliant it was, this scene of him alone on stage.
Right.
You know? But the actors, whenever they're telling this greatest theater stories, it's always this thing that went wrong.
Yeah.
And then the beautiful discovery that was made.
Yes.
She dropped the glass. This one didn't come in. That thing went on fire.
Yeah. Yeah. Use it. It's a gift. Use it.
It's a gift.
How can we use this, you know?
Yeah. And that's the thing. And it's not doing it cerebrally, trying to make it fit in. Like even, you know, Brian in the talk we just had said, you know, if you don't have your oblique strategy cards around and you have a problem, think of the problem and then pick the first object in the room and have faith that that object has the answer.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll give an example of this. So another one of the others, Stephen Labour, the artist. They were making a film about him, a documentary, and he asked me to write some music, a theme for it. And so I had an idea. I just had it was like a very Velvet Underground two chord thing. And instead of any lyrics or anything, he'd left a message describing what he wanted me to do. And I just took that and I made that the vocal. So there was that idea. So he would hear his own voice. And I got to the studio, and this was in East LA, and next door, it was in a house, it was in a friend's house, Ego Plum, another of the others. Mm-hmm. And he was most concerned because somebody had a big generator in their yard next door, and it's making this very loud industrial noise, like, ka-choon, 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 ka-choon. And he said, I can't find anybody who's operating this machine. I think we might have to come back another day. I said to him, Ego, no, just get a mic and put it outside and record that thing because I love it. I don't want it to stop. I don't want us to miss this. He said, what? Really? I said, yeah, just record that. So we dragged the mic out and we recorded it. And I said, okay, I'm going to base everything around that. And then it stopped. And then we had this captured, you know, this rhythm, this very hard kind of industrial clunking rhythm. And then I played the chords to that rhythm, you know, and then flew in the voice, and it all just all went together beautifully, you know. So that's a really good example of seeing something going wrong as potentially a gift.
I still think I don't know why it's occurring. I guess I do know why it's occurring to me. Is the night that you and Jen, well, you the band and Genesis was staying at Rick Rubin's house.
Yes.
So for you don't know, Rick Rubin's this legendary producer who I had to do this talk. I did this talk. I didn't want to do it, and it was for free, and it was far away. But I don't know how I ended up having to do it. Even for a business, it was like, what am I even doing here? And I ended up though in a room for an hour waiting with Rick Rubin. So I was like, oh my God, I complained the whole way, and now I'm having an hour with sort of music Santa Buddha.
Yes.
You know, it's like this awakened being. It was really a life-changing thing to hear the way he puts things together. And
yeah, so you had a good chat with him there.
Yeah. Yeah, it just made a whole a nightmare worth it. I was just like, oh, this is, God is he, God is good, God is great. You know, it was one of those, because I got to spend this hour. But I've never fully understood the story of what happened the night that Jen, I know that Jen jumped her L out a window because there was a fire and fucked up his arm really badly. Mm. It had pins and all this for years. But apparently he said that there was like a voodoo doll involved in this. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you could sort of set the record straight as far as there is one of what kind of what happened that night.
Yeah. Okay. It's a big story. So this goes back to, I referenced it earlier, Cinematic, when Psyche TV were playing there. And that's when I saw Timothy Leary there. Also, John Lydon was there. I was actually hanging out with John Lydon as the band were coming on. I was in the crowd with him. And because the story starts here. Actually, it starts before that. Let's go back to the start. Let's go to the very first moment when this story...
I was born in...
Well, not that far back. But Jen was coming to town, into LA, and Psyche TV needed a place to rehearse. And he asked me if I knew of anywhere. So Love and Rockets were rehearsing, working on new material for a new album, because we just signed to Rick Rubin's label, American Recordings. And he kindly offered for us to stay at his house, me and Daniel, because Kevin, my brother, was already living in LA. But he said, yeah, why don't you stay at one of my houses, you know, which is a beautiful Spanish-style mansion up in the Laurel Canyon. And he said, and just, you know, you can rehearse there. So it's where they recorded Red Hot Chili Peppers, the album he did with them. Well, he's done a couple, but the first album he did with them, Blood, Sugar, Sex, Magic, right. That one. And he said, set up the amps and the drums and everything, just rehearse, you know, work on material there. So we said, yes, thank you very much. So we had this set up, and then I thought, well, maybe they can just Psychic TV come here and even use our gear, you know. So I asked, you know, I asked Rick's people, and they said, okay, fine, yeah, cool. So he came down, and the band did rehearse. And then we had this night where the band had gone home, and it was us three, Kevin, myself, and Daniel, and Jen. And we were rehearsing as a trio, and then Jen said, do you mind if I join in? You know, we'd have a jam session. We said, no, great, do it. So he had his old, his original bass that he had in Throbbing Gristle and the Gristleizer.
Right.
He had an 8-string bass and the Gristleizer box, effects box. So we just, and we started playing this song piece. And it was really powerful. And this sort of monster riff just came out of nowhere. And then Daniel and I we found ourselves, we both felt this afterwards, that we were channeling something, and we found ourselves chanting weird lines like, hey, you owe me money, and it's coming through the hot wire, things like that. And it was mysterious, and it was epic. And then we had recorded this on a cassette machine. And after we finished playing it was about 18 minutes long, we thought, we can't play anything else. Nothing could follow that. So we didn't play anything else. And that was the night that Kevin, my brother, went home. Jen was staying with me in the back room of the house, and Daniel was staying in the other wing. And we all went to bed. At the Psyche TV gig, Jen got up onto the stage, and he never actually sang a song. He started to rant, and just, he was just talking a lot about the people that were there. He was talking about, we have some revolutionaries in the audience tonight: John Lydon, Timothy Leary. He had a pill on his tongue, and he kept sticking his tongue out. And then some woman got onto the stage and was grappling with him. And they were on the floor, and then the security pulled her off, And then he got back up and then just collapsed. And he didn't get back up. And the bandages are looking at each other. They're kind of vamping on something, but then it's just like, he's not getting up. So security take him outside. And he comes round, but he was, you know, very distraught.
Right.
And obviously the show was not going to happen. Anyway, we ended up going back to the house. Paramedics turned up before this, and he just fobbed them off. He said, I'm fine. He wasn't really fine, but we went back to the house, and a vigil ensued, and we stayed up because we wanted to keep him awake because we didn't know. He'd taken something, but we didn't know what it was. And we were concerned. So Lisa Looper, who was his personal assistant, was with him, and me. I think Billy Goodrum was there, who was also in Psychic TV. He's the guy I went to visit Tim with.
Right.
Circuitous. Yeah. Convoluted. Anyway, we were up for a few hours, and then Jen, he seemed to really perk up, and he insisted that we all go to bed, and he felt bad us all staying up because it's unnecessary. Please, everybody go to bed. So we went to bed. And then he was sleeping on the couch in the main room in this sort of big hall. And I got up quite early the next day and I went down to check on him. He wasn't there, but what was there in place of him was this really malevolent-looking voodoo doll that had black skin. It looked like real skin of some sort. It had real hair, like gray hair, little red ribbons tied into the hair, a lace dress, a very delicate necklace of tiny shells. And then Jen comes in. I said, Jen, what is this? He said, that's the weirdest thing. He said, I woke up and that thing was stuffed down the crotch of my pants. So very weird. And I felt like he should take it outside. Yeah. I said, it's very, very disturbing. This thing. He said, yes, isn't it? He said, I want to speak to it. I said, okay. So that night he goes into the grounds with Lisa and he finds a spot. They went over the hole like 4 acres, I don't know. And they found this spot. And they created a circle of salt on this big paving slab. Lisa held the doll outside the circle. Jen went inside the circle and tried to communicate with the doll and said, you know, I mean you no harm. Hopefully you mean me no harm. I don't know who you are, what this is about, but, you know, please just understand where I'm coming from. And if you have anything to say to me, please tell me. Nothing was perceived in that moment, but then Jen went to sleep and had this dream, a very vivid dream, where there was this sort of haze of like smoke and the doll appeared to him through this haze and said to him, I came to make you love yourself, and then retreated backwards through the haze, disappeared, and he woke up. So he told me this dream. And I thought, I better know where that circle of salt is. Now, when I first arrived at the house, this is when I was very, very into magic. And I was working with Alan Moore, our friend. And when I got to the house, I wanted to, this was a period where I was making these fetish objects. And I would perceive an element and a theme and then make the necessary components come to me. And what I perceived in that space in Rick's grounds was snake and fire being the element. So I went round the grounds and I found my little power spot. I just intuitively, this is what I do. And I sat in that spot and I thought, I bet that circle of salt is in that spot. And sure enough, I go out on the balcony, look down, there's a circle of salt in that exact spot. Mm. And I could identify it because it was like crazy paving, big slabs. So that was a bit freaky. Now we're caught up. Now we're in the house. We've had the jam session, gone to bed. Next thing I know, like very early in the morning, 7 o'clock, something like that. Somebody shouting, fire, fire. And there was a fire. And I'm in the back room with Jen. And so you could, even at that point, you could kind of feel the heat of it. And I opened the door, which led into a corridor. We're on the first upper level. And I saw smoke starting to come up the stairs. So I thought, we've got to get out. And the only way out was through the window. So we opened the window. We threw a few items out, like guitars. We threw all the bedding out first so the guitars could land softly. And then Jen went in front of me. And I was right behind him, so I saw this. And lost his footing and swiveled around, tried to grab a branch, didn't get it, fell backwards, landed. And his head was just outside the circle of salt.
Mm.
And then I jumped out fine. He was in a bit of apart from having sustained that very serious injury, he was also asthmatic and he couldn't breathe. So I had to find his inhaler. Mm. So I was going through these bags and I found it and I administered it. And then I went around the corner and I saw Daniel just in a bemused state looking at these roaring flames coming out of the room that held all of our gear, you know, the main rehearsal room. So it was, yeah, that happened. Anyway, Jen ended up in the hospital and I've paid a visit. And it was quite a funny moment there because I said, you know, how are you doing, Jen? And he was quite heavily sedated, but he was still compos mentis and quite perky, really. And he said, they're giving me my favorite meal, potatoes and peas with gravy. So he was pleased about that. And I said, well, what's the prognosis, you know? Well, he said, well, the doctor said, I will be able to play the guitar. And I couldn't resist it. I said, well, that's funny, Jen. You couldn't play it before the accident. He says, you bastard. Only an English person could come out with something like that, which is true. This is the longest story I know, but you asked for it. anyway, then I said, what happened to that doll? And he said, we took it back inside. Huh? And I said, where did you put it? And he said, in the hallway, it was in a brown paper bag. I said, okay. And he said, in fact, I contacted these Voudon experts, friends of mine, and described it in detail. And what they said was that it's a traditional love doll that has been altered in order to create fire. And the red ribbons tied in the hair have that particular intention. So they said, you must find the doll and you must take it to the opposite element, which is water, of course. And they said, you have to find it, you have to tie a lump of metal to it, put it in a box, seal the box and take it to water and submerge it. So Lisa, she broke back into the grounds to try and find this doll, like thinking, no, it's not going to be there. But sure enough, it was there. And it was in the center, like where the fire, we found out later, where the fire started in that hallway. That's where it was. And it was intact. So this thing is made of, it was real human hair, lace, cotton, completely intact. Daniel's saxophone in the other room melted. The cymbals from the drum kit, which he borrowed from Steve Perkins from Jane's Addiction, melted. This doll, completely intact. Anyway, it's uncanny. Lisa took it, left the building, and they had also another thing that the voodoo people said was that you have to burn off its face with this particular like acid, and then you submerge it in a bath of this stuff, and then put it in the box, and then tie this thing, and then take it down to the river. So she was following these instructions, and then she was on her way down to the waterfront, and decided to stop off at Cedar Sinai and check in on Jen. She had this thing in the back of her car. She felt intuitively that she shouldn't leave it in the car, but she didn't want to take it inside. So she took it out, and this was like wee small hours in the morning. To conceal it, she put it inside a trash can that was on the street, thinking, well, you know, that'll be safe for half an hour, and I'll come back and pick it up and put it back in the car, go down to the waterfront. She sees Jen, comes back only to see the refuse disposal truck scoop up that very trash can and empty the contents into the back of the truck. And it goes off to landfill. So, I mean, it went to the element of earth, not to the element of water. So I'm no idea how that configures in the whole sort of magical voodoo scheme of things. But that's the story.
Did Jen later ever say or believe that the entire debacle helped him love himself?
No, but there's a follow-up to this story. And I went to see Psychic TV when they returned to the stage and returned to LA. And Jen was playing for the first time. And it was a new group configuration.
They were always a new.
Yeah, I know. They were all wearing white.
Uh-huh.
And and Jen had started, you know, the transitions, you know, the surgeries. And looked very different, but kind of great in a way. And very alive. And at one point in that gig, somebody shouted out, "I love you, Jen." And he goes up to the mic and says, "I love me too." And I thought, oh my God. And in that moment, I thought, I came to make you love yourself. And if he hadn't gone through that whole experience, he wouldn't be in that place right there and then saying those words. Mm. And I think he really did come to love himself. And I know that he, prior to the fire, he was full of self-loathing.
Right.
And I think it really transformed him in a very positive way.
Yeah, he moved into self-loathing. Partly he felt he had let his family down by getting kicked out of England and being too, daring with videos.
Yeah.
Too contemptuous that he let his children down. Yes. You know, and I think that was the moment he was in those early LA days. And
yeah. Another little detail to the story, though, the aforementioned Howard Hallis was there filming the whole thing of the gig at the Cinematic. So we thought, after the fire, we thought, let's go back and look at that video.
See who the woman is. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. So we go back and it's completely blank. And Howard said the red light, which means you're recording, was on all the time. And this camera's fully operational, used it all the time. This had never happened. And it's completely inexplicable. So it's just blanked
out. Wow. She somehow avoided.
Yes.
Dang.
It was obvious that, you know, she stuffed that doll down there when she was grappling with him on the stage.
Right. That she planted the doll, but somehow avoided capture.
Yeah, it's weird that he was not cognizant of it before, you know, the first thing in the morning. But then again, he was pretty altered.
Yeah.
He was altered. Very weird.
I mean, it leaves you, you know, and I know some people don't like that I've been into magic lately, but you have to believe in the inexplicable, at least, you know, the uncanny. Mm. And that the uncanny offers us maps, if nothing else. It offers us maps and tools for negotiating the unseeable.
Yeah.
Do you have a practice of any sort?
I did at the time of that fire.
Right.
But I've moved away from that. I mean, I was experimenting with ritual and structure in that way. But I had, you know, that being one of many very intense experiences, I was aware that this is, you can catch a tiger by the tail, you know.
Yeah.
And when you're operating in the magical realm, and it's not advisable to be too cavalier in that area.
Or even, oddly enough, too intentional, you know, because you get what you want.
Yeah, it's like the monk is poor, you know, you don't know how that will manifest.
Right.
It's very true.
Go gently. You know, because I'm friends with Grant, and thanks to you, I'm going to meet Alan Moore and talk with him. And, you know, a bunch of you know, practicing occultists. And I don't feel not secure enough. I don't feel committed enough to my intentions to do workings on that level. I would like to be safe, but I'm much more interested in seeing what's unfolding. I mean, the universe has such better ideas for what to bring to me than I do myself, you know?
But then you are part of that. You are part of that universe. So you are part of that which is gifting you, you know? You are so intrinsically connected with that fabric of the universe. So
right.
You're not apart from it. And that is like, that is the magical realm, perceiving that and how that is malleable with intention, with representative ritual.
Right.
You can manifest. But then again, you can only control it to a certain degree, and that's when it gets tricky.
Right, and there's a balance. It's a balance between sort of accepting what's happening and maybe navigating a little bit on.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very intensely aware of this sort of magical interconnection and vibration all the time, but I'm not actively seeking to contain it or use it in a way to manifest my desires. It's really on a kind of a low hum level, and it comes into play when I'm working in the ways that we've talked about during this conversation, where you just allow the unexpected and the unpredictable to occur, and then play with it. You know, interact with it on that level, and that is magic.
Right. And it's fun and creative and it's reassuring, you know, rather than mechanical or, you know, I'm going to engineer my fate. It's like, no, I'm going to dance. I'm going to dance with the universe.
Right. I also think with magicians, there's a tendency. It's very common for the magician, having achieved a certain amount of extraordinary success or a success in extraordinary things, to perceive that you are the one that is the all powerful, you know, you are the magus, the ego comes into play, you know. I think a prime example of that is Aleister Crowley, you know, and it backfires very seriously.
And I guess it did on him too. I mean, he was.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's the opposite. I mean, but that's the thing. It's what I felt like I learned from Jen, and what again was reinforced by you just last night, was it's an open heart, and gentility is it's the strongest, you know. It just, it changes, it also encourages a different understanding of masculinity. You know, I was watching you on stage, because you're lithe and gentle and listening and open, but then there's a masculinity in it as well, which is very different from like the sort of American masculinity that I was taught growing up. And it's part of why I think you were in so many of our lives, because you represented a different sort of masculine role model. Well, I mean, not that that was your intention, but you know what I mean?
I'm very, very in touch with my feminine side, you know?
Right. But that's a different, it's not the toxic masculinity of, you know, the whatever that.
Oh, the manosphere.
Yeah.
No, please spare me. That's just abhorrent.
Right, no. But a rock star all the same.
Oh, thank you. You're a rock star too, Douglas.
Thank you. I know, but that's the thing.
Takes one to know one.
Oh, thank you. I know. That's a good place to end. I'm really honored to be in your extended family in Constellation, the seniors of
yes,
and look
likewise.
Forward. Oh, thank you. And I look forward to for so much more. Please, everybody. And of course, you already listened to the music, I'm assuming. But get this. Get this. It's out of stock everywhere, but you could, I'm sure, pre-order it and they'll bring
they're
it back.
They're doing a third edition now.
In fact, it
should be printed next week.
You see, this is what happens. It comes back around. Who would think? A little book of poems with this picture on it. Man, look at that fucker. It wasn't done for it, but it turns out it was.
Yeah, artist is Holly Albright, and it's the perfect illustration for the contents of that book.
Yeah, it's really so. Do check this out. Thank you, David Jay, for everything.
Pleasure.
And look, you've been on Team Human, right? We're produced by Joshua Chapdelaine, edited by Luke Robert Mason. You can support this effort by going to patreon.com/teamhuman and become a paying member of the team. You get access to our Discord, live things. We're doing these show premieres. We're probably doing for this one. We do these premieres on YouTube, and then afterwards we spend an hour together talking about it. We've got we got Discord. We're doing free events, free live things. Well, soon something like this will happen in a nightclub in New York, and Team Human subscribers get to come in for free to those. And most importantly, you keep this thing going and you don't have to listen to any ads. We love you a lot. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and you've been on Team Human, our last best hope for peeps.